This was a period of growth of pharmacology as a basis for therapeutics. For the industry, they were adding on scientists to follow the path of pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics in developing new products. And the industry was faced by the need for legislation and were greatly concerned, but the patent medicine or over-the-counter group realized it was life or death, and this was a subject from 1937 on that gave a concern to everybody in the industry. Well, it resulted in 1937 where the Wheeler and Lee, Senator Wheeler and Representative Lee, sponsored a bill which gave the Federal Trade Commission power over advertising and would ban false advertising. And that was the Wheeler-Lee Act, which gave the Federal Trade Commission the responsibility, and that was passed in March of 1938. And on the other side, the Food and Drug Administration were dissatisfied with the provision of the old 1906 Act, which essentially was an act prohibiting misbranding of drugs, and as a result of the Massengill tragedy, the Congress passed the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. That was in June. That was the same year. And that law, in essence, required that a drug be, quote, safe for use, unquote. That was the original provision. Later in 62, yeah. There was an amendment which required that a drug have therapeutic usefulness, and that a definition of efficacy be provided in the Food and Drugs new drug application. Mm-hmm. But it also greatly changed the the enforcement of the act. However, for those of us that had adopted pharmacology years ago, it wasn't a great handicap because we were already
doing it.
Yeah, the prescription drug industry were already with their FDAs assessing metabolism, which is part of pharmacology of drugs, excretion, endpoint, effectiveness, so that we were then, you might say, as a prescription drug manufacturer, operating essentially under the provisions of the law and of 38 and the amendment. So this was the atmosphere, and I'm giving you this because with this background, it was, of course, of particular interest to us as McNeil, putting out products for the physician, that we avoid drugs that were showing up to have toxicity, such as acetamilin. Mm-hmm. And acetamilin's toxicity was because it's broken down in the body to N-acetylpyraminophenol, which is the chemical name for Tylenol acetaminophen, for acetaminophen, and aniline. And the side effects, which were very apparent and the toxicity acute, where the aniline in the body. That was a sign. And it was the skillful work of the pharmacologists such as Lester and Greenberg at Yale, and then with the study of other products, other pharmacologists were showing the fate, as we would call it, of the drugs, F-A-T-E, and we couldn't help it, you see, pick up a lot of information in the scientific committee meetings about what was going on from the investigators themselves. In other words, our men, and our head of our pharmacology was David Marsh, who had been head of the department at the University of Virginia Medical School. So they had many contacts, and they were looking beyond just the immediate product that might have been in the lab and into what would make sense for McNeil as a product. And they were as concerned as I was about safety for use of any product we put out. So let's say that the whole industry with capable scientific people were quite aware of what was appearing in the literature, and it was primarily the generally pharmacology and experimental therapeutics, which was a reputable, you see, journal carrying this material. Well, along comes a study of the metabolism of N-acetylcholine aminophenol by Steve Brody and his group in New York, and they were now interested, and they proved very conclusively that that was the effective metabolite of the drug. And the patent medicine people in the meantime had organized this institute for the study of analgesic and sedative drugs, because they realized that they had to have reputable studies, and instead of doing it themselves and reporting from the company labs, which they felt was covered, they had farmed out these studies to the Lester and group at Yale and Brody group at in New York, and on the basis that the results could be accepted by everybody. And of course the unfortunate thing is that it didn't help them, but it in substantiating the safety of the drug, it did just the opposite. It proved that some of them, like acetylene, had to be dropped forever.
Now, McNeil wasn't one of the original companies that belonged to the Institute?
No, they were all patent medicine, I can tell you.
Oh,
all
right.
Patent medicine people, and we started with about 8, and it was headed by a chap at Miles Laboratory, which had a subsidiary called Ames, and he was a Harvard MD, and that's why he felt that I think and convinced them that they should get together. And after the first 8, because these were companies that marketed primarily bromides and acetylene, they were able to get American Home and some of the others who were also selling over-the-counter products in the same field. So, but they were essentially what we call in the industry patent medicine companies, or over-the-counter direct products, products that were advertised directly to the public.
Right.
And they, of course, were marketing aspirin. And why didn't they market a product, acetaminophenol? Well, how are they going to introduce a product and say it's better than aspirin? They were in a dilemma.
Right.
Sterling, on the other hand, over in England, were following this, and they thought, well, we'll try to put out a product, and they put out Panadol. But they didn't bring it on the market in the United States. And the story of that is in Maine, and when that's confirmed, as in my statements, in other words, are confirmed by Maine and all their studies. But to get back to, you see, the Institute, the subsidiary of Miles Laboratory, Ames, you see, would have been an ideal place to introduce the product because they were selling to physicians. They were selling prescription products to physicians. Whereas the parent, Miles Laboratory, was selling over the counter.
So they just...
You can imagine their dilemma.
Oh, okay. Right, because it's part of the parent company. Okay.
Now, Squibb, on the other hand, thought they would make a go of it, so they added it to a acetophenedetin, which breaks down also to N-acetylpyrimethanol, and they thought that here would be a good opportunity for them, you see, to try it out, because they had, Squibb, you see, had over-the-counter products, so at that time they were considered as much over-the-counter as they were as prescription. But two people who had received the product died of a granulocytosis.
This is what, Trigesic?
Yeah.
Oh, what's this thing that they got, the patients?
What?
What was the condition that the patient...
Well, that's covered in here.
A granulocytosis.
Sometimes
I see words that I've never heard.
Well, that
spoken.
Was part of it, and... it was very important, you see, that was a diagnosis and not methemoglobinuria, which is a coloring of the body and quite different. But because the blood picture, you see, was so clear cut that they withdrew the product. But this was very closely studied by everybody, and many reports were released among the manufacturers, but the conclusion was, and it was even mentioned in the symposium, the conclusion to everybody was that it wasn't N-acetylpyrimethanol that caused the agranulocytosis. No way. Medical group, and it was reported in the symposium. Our Jim Schaefer talked directly, our head of our clinical talked directly with the others. We saw the results of the blood tests and saw the reports of the blood tests and all. So that when we did become interested later on, we had, let's say, everyone that had been involved, including the top people here, had said that no way could N-acetylpyrimethanol have caused the agranulocytosis or contributed to the death of the patient. So, to answer your question, you see, that concern was dismissed before we marketed the product.
So then you come back to McNeil saying, why don't we try and manufacture this thing?
I was approached by Ray Conklin, the medical director and research director for Ames, who also had been an officer of the Institute for the Study of Analgesic and Sedative Drugs, a very well-qualified individual whose CV, you call it bibliography, whatever, what's the term you want?
CV.
All right. We will file with you. And with the question of why wouldn't we be interested in marketing the product based on the number of studies and the capability of the investigators of marketing a, I should say, and I'll correct it, an acetylparaminophenol product. And I know him through industry meetings well enough to discuss it briefly, and I became convinced with my knowledge of the situation and pharmacology, only as a generalist, but sufficient knowledge to say this was an opportunity for McNeil to do something, that there was a niche for McNeil. We were not selling aspirin over the counter, and we were selling aspirin combinations, but there's no reason why I couldn't. So when I returned, I asked Jim Cade, the head of our medical science division, and Jim Schaefer to contact the individuals who headed these the pharmacology groups and the clinical investigation groups and discuss with them directly their experience, because we had the and reviewed the pharmacology with the head of our pharmacology department. So much was reported that it was very easy to get a hold of primary information before the discussion. And as a result of their discussion, I said, well, we're going to suggest sort of neophenol product at the next meeting of the New Products Committee, which is a group of head of research, head of clinical, head of, my brother, head of marketing, with head of sales, head of advertising, and product research, Doug Lovell, and that group met regularly, and so I presented it to them, to the group, with the, of course, the endorsement of the scientific side, and the met the with some resistance from the sales group, because in spite of the let's say lack of toxicity and effectiveness as an analgesic and an antipyretic, you see, but without the irritation of the stomach and therefore safer than aspirin, with that presentation, they still said, how can you compete with aspirin that's been sold for so many years and cost less, and in essence said they didn't see how they could sell it. But having been the head of the committee and the senior officer, I said, well, we'll find a niche where we can sell it to physicians, and we will develop it, you see, as a specialty business which you can sell and will not compete with the over-the-counter, even though we knew, of course, that There were products for pediatric use in the asthma field, such as St. Joe's, you know, have wide use for pediatrics. So,
but yeah, that's what I was wondering, why you started with the infant market, which seemed, you know, if you're going to start with something new, to choose the most fragile systems, seems like.
Well, the answer to your question is, we're wondering about that, and we started there because we had formulated this elixir of Budesolv and other products, and we had in mind, and we presented to them, an elixir of N-acetylpyrimethylphenol as a concept, pediatric use. Pediatricians much prefer a liquid dosage form to tablets. And so with some, what do I say, skepticism on their part, we proceeded. And the pharmaceutical development group developed along with an elixir along the lines of the elixir of Budesolv, with the experience that we'd had, this is when you're a small company, some of us see it had experience from the liquid program, the emulsion program, the elixir of Budesolv right on through it, which we gave for the benefit of then Al Maddox, who headed the pharmaceutical development. And they produced this nice palatable elixir of N-acetylpyrimethylphenol. So we got to go ahead from then. We submitted an FDA application as a prescription drug. It would have been safe enough if we submitted it as a tablet. It would have been over the counter, but we submitted it, you see, as a new drug. Why a new drug? Well, there was no elixir of N-acetylpyrimethylphenol had been introduced on the market. So
I was going to ask you a little bit, well, maybe I'm interrupting here, but about the clinical trials that were conducted.
Well, for a new drug application, we had to do a clinical trial. So we went to pediatricians, and the key person, there were two of them, Lou Warmley and
there's a guy named Cornelly.
Yeah, they're here in Philadelphia. They did the original work after, of course, being convinced that it was safe for use. But there was one study which is a key indicates what they did. Actually, they did far more than this one paper, but that was the key paper. And it gave them the opportunity to be the first Kincaid went to Cornelly and Ritter and of course gave them all of the background, and with all the scientific material to assure them of toxicity, and we had done our own toxicity. Remember, we in our new application had to submit toxicity, and in addition to the citing the literature, and at that time Steve Brody had already down in the NIH, so he was acknowledged as one of the top people in the country. But with that background, you see, you go to a clinician, and after satisfying him of the safety for use, you see, that the first hurdle, then he takes it, you see, to determine the effectiveness. And we did it very carefully, and this group were at the Philadelphia General Hospital, which was then part of the pediatrics, and the Graduate Hospital, which was then under the University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There was a group there of young Turks in quote, mm-hmm. who were the bright young guys who wanted to start a graduate school, and they had in name down there, and do the cutting edge work in medicine down at Graduate. And that included Drips, two comrades, Keddie, who was a top, and someone else. And you know, Philadelphia, five. The brightest guys in Philadelphia. And they were very helpful, you see, in assessing what we did at this stage. This is where we use consultants.
Mm-hmm.
And advising who to go to, and I don't mind saying it, assuring Cornley and Ritter, you see, that it was a product that they could administer effectively and not worry about toxicity. I mean, more work had been done, frankly, in the pharmacology of acetylpyraminophenol than, you see, up to that point, almost any drug.
Right.
New drug. I mean, it had a vast amount of experience. And, for instance, some of the Bannerman and Grossman, analgesic effectiveness and safety of acetylpyraminophenol, Federation proceedings, I mean, it had been studied by many after the original studies. So therefore, the two of them, Cornley and Ritter, could go ahead with assurance that it was all right, by saying good conscience as a physician, and they were impressed with the dramatic reduction in fever for these little tots who had 103-104 degree temperatures soar quickly, and some of them
to read this paper.
Yeah.
Because the kids had tuberculosis and all sorts of things that you don't think of kids having. But it was also interesting to me that there were 121 cases studied. You know, I imagine that clinical trials these days include thousands of patients.
Well, in this first wave, 141. Yeah. Well, when they're well studied, it's how well they're studied. You know, in the first run, remember your first cases are not the 5,000 are now required in the different stages.
Right.
And 5,000, I might add, isn't enough today to pick up things that have happened to some products when it got to 1 million patients, then where they found some problems.
Right.
Let's say 5,000, let me correct that on the tape to say 100,000 or 200,000, you see, 20 to 40 times. But a well-studied group, and that's why these fellows, in our minds, get credit, you see, for doing the first clinical work. Then you expand, you submit everything to the FDA. Keep in mind, even with placebos, you get 15% of the patients reporting some side reaction. This is how difficult clinical assessment is. It's not easy because you administer a placebo, you see, and the patient doesn't know it, same color, same taste and everything, and you get up to maybe 15% side effects, dizziness, headaches, or something.
Right, right. Of course, this study didn't have any control group at all. At least they didn't discuss any in the paper. Everybody was given it. Everybody had one sickness or another.
Yeah, because
they were little.
We were beyond that, and we were
children.
Yeah, we didn't want to make any chances either. Frankly, I mean, remember, our boys put themselves in the position of the physician who's doing it. I mean, our physician, they go down there. They're part of it. We had another Dr. Schaefer, who was a pediatrician, on our staff inside. And, you know, they really spend time, you know, right there with the patient in the early stages. And, well,
you shouldn't going to need to flip it. I'm going to flip it.